Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB Club 1220. Tom, you are still here, correct?
You are absolutely correct.
15th hour of consecutive airtime, right?
And I've got, there's another person who's still here, too. Mm-hmm. I wonder who that would be.
That'd be Stan Turner.
Hi, Tom. We've got a sleeping cot for you in the next room. And as soon as you pass the 35-hour mark, you can go lie down. Okay.
Well, in case anyone cared to know, I'm Tom Osmond.
We do care to know, Tom.
We do care.
I care. You know, I don't know about him, but I care.
I'm full of caring.
This is a very caring group. We were chatting before the show started. And did you think that 27 years ago today, we'd be thinking this is the old days? The old days, yeah. Twins won the World Series. Mm-hmm. It was quite an amazing year that year. They were a wild card team, mm-hmm. kind of limped their way into the playoffs, mm-hmm. which was amazing itself. Yeah. Won the American League Championship. And you were there that night. They won Game 7. You were at the mm-hmm. Skybox. What was that place called? The Metro Macro Dome,
yeah, something like that.
It's collapsed a couple times since then.
The Humpty Dome,
yeah, that's right.
Something like that. Yeah, I remember it quite well. And yes, it was another time, another era. The team, the Twins, could be raggedy, and they were. But they were like the Vikings, too. They could pull out victories where you thought it was not possible, and they did it that year. And they looked pretty good. They had pitching. They had hitting. They had fielding. They had it all. And sometimes it didn't come together, and sometimes, boy, when it did, when everything intersected, you could carry home a World Series championship, and they did.
But unlike your Vikings, though, the Twins had never. Well, actually, they
don't call them my Vikings, boy. Yeah, they're not the ones I used to know.
Offensive.
This is a Packer station.
Glad
anyway.
You played that disclaimer at the beginning of the show.
That's what it's all about.
I remember what I said last week that we have that now. But unlike the Minnesota Vikings, not Stan Turner's Vikings,
no.
But they were in a couple. About four championship games. They did win the American, the AFL championship one time. The Twins had one bad run in the World Series. They played, it was the Dodgers, correct, if I know my history correctly, in 65. And 22 years later, we're in the World Series. And now that was 27 years ago. Tonight, actually. Tonight is the big anniversary tonight.
I think it's all about, it's almost like radio and TV. People seem to attach to people they know and trust on the playing field or on the air. Back then, back in the old days, you could attach to Frank Viola and people mm-hmm. like that, Kirby Puckett, all the rest of them, Kent Herbick. These were, if they didn't live here, they were still regarded as hometown heroes, mm-hmm. somebody that if you saw on the street, and you might see them on the street, you could say hello, and they'd smile back at you and say hello, too. It truly was a community. These guys, maybe they still do, but they'd go up to hospitals and see mm-hmm. sick kids and do good things in the community. They didn't have to be pushed out the door to do it. So there was something in the air then that was different from today. It's too bad. I mourn its passing, and I miss it.
I think the professional athletes, excuse me, will disagree with me on this, but I think that in that time, that era, we'll call it the 70s, 80s, 60s, they weren't making the millions they're making today.
No.
So they did charities. That was part of their, you know, their PR. Right now it's I have money I need to put into a tax shelter. Let's do a charity. There's been a couple stories the last few months of some of our—
And I'll sell you my autograph.
Sell you my autograph? Well, that was Sid Hartman, I think, that sells his
right
autograph.
Right here,
buy a shirt from him
on
state
what
sale.
I'll tell you what,
But the this is a part-time job for these guys. I mean, there was Minnesota Vikings that were selling cars, you know, in the off-season, you know, back,
true.
You know, 25, 30 years ago.
It's true.
I want to, before we get into this conversation, which is a great one, let's play some audio. Let's pretend that it's Saturday. It's this was, what camera day of the week it was, but it was October 25th, 1987. Mm-hmm. This is what you'd be listening to right after the Game 7, right after the World Series.
Watching KSTP-TV, Minnesota's News Channel 5. Channel 5, Minnesota's News Channel, and the Minnesota Twins Channel for the 1987 World Series.
Well, there it is, still aglow from all the excitement under its white top tonight. The Metrodome, the lights shine, of course, for the Twins players, but they shine for all the fans who believe in this team, believed in them through the lean years, through some hard times, some heartbreaks, some near triumphs. But by golly, they deserve to win it all tonight. Good evening, everybody. Very happy, Ruth Spencer. Happy, that's an understatement.
Oh.
Ecstatic couple of people up here like you are.
Welcome to Twins Fever 87. We did it. My voice is leaving and I don't care.
Me too. Let's go right down to the field to Mark Curtis to find out more about this. What's going on now, Mark?
Thanks very much, Ruth. We're standing by with Gene Larkin, and this has got to be the sweetest thing in the world, especially because there's not one hero. This is a team victory, a team effort all season long.
This group of guys have been unbelievable. If you make a mistake, some guy picks you up. This happened the whole year. Tremendous ball game tonight. Very exciting ball game. Two guys throwing out the plate. I'm just happy. So happy we came out on top.
The nice thing about it is Game 7 turned out to be the best game of the series.
Hey, people said it was a boring series in the beginning, but you can't complain about the excitement in the last few games. Unbelievable. Pitching, hitting, clutch hitting, especially on our part. And, man, I can't believe I'm one of the best.
We're looking at some tape right now, the celebration in the locker room.
There we go.
Wow.
I like the out-of-towners that come to work here at Channel 5, and all of a sudden they're winning championships, months later, mm-hmm. like the former sports director that was on there.
They weren't homers, but they became homers pretty quickly.
Yeah, he was in town for 8 weeks, and they won the World Series.
But you know what? Everybody was caught up in the euphoria.
Right.
And you didn't have to be an old-timer here, a veteran Minnesotan or a Wisconsin, I dare say. Some of the folks from across the border, our good listeners over there, were cheering for us, too. And it was just fun. Fun. I think that's the word. Larkin there, look at, he's kind of a down-to-earth guy. He's not coming off like a celebrity. He was one of us. And then, of course, I'll never forget, and we're seeing this on the screen right now, the victory parade through downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul up to the Capitol where Ruth Spencer, my co-anchor, were located. It was a brutally cold day, but nobody cared. Kirby Puckett had an aviator's helmet on.
And if you remember, all the Twins' wives, they're wearing minks. And that you could not do
fur coats, but mink coats.
It is it's not something that you could do today.
No.
Well, first of all, I think the crowd, when the Twins won in 91, and it was a great World Series too, but the fact that in 87 it was so unbelievable, and we had not ever experienced a World Championship before. It was something so special about that first one. Came out of nowhere, and the crowd down in Minneapolis-St. Paul, I remember watching this on TV, and I had to go to school that day. I didn't miss days of school.
Of course not.
But we were watching live coverage in school because we didn't do any academics that day. We still watched the Twins parade. I remember the parade couldn't get down from Minneapolis-St. Paul because the crowds were so overwhelming. And this is a Minnesota crowd. This is not a L.A., Miami crowd where there's cars tipped over and, there's on fire.
It was the most polite crowd you've ever seen.
Exuberant, but polite.
This is your VFW polka, listening crowd putting in World Series. No, it was you watch even the coverage outside the dome there. There's people everywhere. What Minnesotan says a lot about us for a very polite, calm. We like to be kind of humble, but.
My friends and I talk a lot, and you're my friends, you're among this group. We talk a lot about what has changed. Is it in our minds, or has popular culture changed that much? And I dare say it has in many ways. I'm not going to go into it right now, but it is different. You can look through, look at the past through certain different lenses, but I think there are many things missing today that were there back then, and it helped us, and we really did have a community sense there. And the sense of entitlement, I think the television has so badly corrupted pro sports, even amateur sports, college sports now. In pro sports, these players, they can go out and do a lousy season and sleepwalk through their jobs on the playing field, they're still guaranteed a huge and obscene amount of money. There's no incentive there. They're not playing for the glory. They're showing up if they feel like it. That's a crass overstatement, but there are some good players out there and some very talented athletes. I no doubt about that, but too much of it is all of money, follow the money. That's it.
I guess there is a little bit to be jaded about when you see people like arguing, I'm only getting paid $35 million. He's getting paid $37 million. I demand my two more million.
They lose me right there. Yeah. I'm out. I'm not going to be a sports fan. I'm just checking out. I'm not going to do it.
Well, the idea that you only can win World Series now if you have a George Steinbrenner-like payroll. And that's, he won a few World Series because he was willing to take every player from the league and pay him.
He bought the title in a way.
Carl Pollard did not do that. The big – we played a few weeks ago. We had Rob Lear on the show. One of the funny – it's turned out to be funny – 20, 30 years later, that Carl Pollard was going to be the anti-Calvin Griffith. He was going to spend money on the Twins, and he did. I mean, he did spend money, just not the kind of money that the other big owners were spending money on.
Yeah.
And Calvin Griffith, he was a baseball guy. He was not a banker. He was not a business guy. He was a guy who owned a baseball team. Yeah. You don't just own a baseball team today. You own something.com.
Oh, it's part of your portfolio.
It's for your portfolio.
Yeah,
it's what you do for fun when you go after work and sit in the suite.
Right. That's absolutely right. And in the Twins' case, they dumped all their payroll a few years ago into two players, basically, Morneau and Joe Mauer.
The other one,
right. There goes your payroll. Well, we need a pitcher. Can't afford it. We got two guys on the payroll here, one of whom is sitting in the hot tub through the entire season. He's a good guy. Mauer's a good guy, talented, gifted athlete, but he's been sick. He's been ill a lot, and it's nothing's happening out there on the field. I long for these days that we're talking about today. It was fun.
Well, let's take some more fun. This is some audio from the day of the parade. This is some after parade coverage, and let's see if we can pretend that it's those good old days we so long for.
If there had been a balloon for every person who cheered the Twins today, you wouldn't have seen the sky. If there had been confetti for every single smile, the streets would have disappeared. Who would have thought that so many people would want so much to share one last moment of Twins magic? Good evening, everyone. It was a spectacular display and one which will take up a good part of this expanded Eyewitness News update.
As it deserves to, too, right?
Yes.
Right. Hundreds of thousands of people, probably you, gathered in downtown Minneapolis, downtown St. Paul, and the State Capitol Mall to honor the World Series heroes on this Day of Champions. Mark Sapelsa leads our team coverage on the two parades and the Capitol rally.
They scaled clocks, checked their cameras, collected confetti, gearing up for the Minnesota Parade of the Century.
We have about four or five bags strategically located.
And who are you aiming for?
Anybody.
Including newscasters, huh? I was right. Waiting for the Twins, she practiced on this reporter. Johnny Brinkhouse hit the books waiting for his heroes, wasting no time during his day off from school.
Can you say, win Twins?
Win Twins.
However you say it, those winning Twins were just around the corner. Hundreds of thousands rushed Minneapolis's Marquette Avenue to catch an arm's-length glance of the world champions, and the champs loved it.
Al, how do you feel?
Hi, how you doing? Great!
Word that the 33-car Twins motorcade was nearing sent fans streaming in its path for a look. The Skycam showed a completely clogged downtown, leaving a view for just a few, including clever construction workers.
Couldn't see anything. It was a thrill to be here, though.
Once the parade finally pushed its way through, a final thanks for the memories that won't fade fast.
Who did you get to see?
I didn't get to see anything. I had someone on top of my shoulders.
Was that her?
Yeah.
Who did you get to see?
We got to see Roy Bautista. Everybody. Her
number one.
Number one.
At least one here. 1 foot of confetti, that is. Enough souvenir for everyone to take home, keep, and remember. From downtown Minneapolis, I'm Mark Sapelsa for the Eyewitness News Update.
Save your confetti, because it'll be a long time before you use it next time. It's one of those things where if you save it, it's like, why'd I save that now?
looking back, how many years ago was that?
27 years ago today.
I'm sure Channel 4 and 11, I'm kind of proud of that. Our producers put together a fine package there. And looking back on it, I feel a sense of pride being
it
part of that.
It wasn't about the mayhem, the destruction, or anything crazy.
No,
it was just about people being happy.
The writing was very nice, and it was legitimate emotion.
Yeah.
Sapelsa there out in the streets, and Ruthie Spencer, and everybody was being herself. Nobody was acting. It was just the real thing. We're just letting ourselves. We were, call it tribal. We were community. Everybody was together. There was no rank. It was just everybody having a blast.
Well, everyone, if you want to watch that, tcmedianow.com, you can watch the parade video. You can watch the news coverage the day, night of the World Series Game 7. You can see Stan giving his.
Look at that.
But. Well, you might want to pause on that and watch it. No, it is great.
You're not supposed to agree with me on that.
You pause on Stan, you watch it longer.
Oh, I see. Thank you. I misunderstood. Well, let me slap my face. There we go. I slapped my face.
Okay. Hey, it comes to my show, I'm going to insult him? I think not. But it's great footage. We were talking before the show started. Everyone had a VCR. Well, VCRs are pretty well in American homes, Minnesota homes at this point.
Good.
Everyone taped Game 7. I get a lot of tapes. People give me, here's a box of tapes. They usually don't check what's in them. But I see Game 7, and then, of course, rolls over to this newscast. Mm-hmm. So you've been probably in many people's libraries of tapes for over the years.
I still hear about it. Somebody will say, hey, I watched you last night. And I said, what? Why? I haven't done TV for quite a while.
Said,
no, we're looking at the videotape that we taped of the Game 7, and there you guys are, you and Ruthie Spencer. So I guess we live on, like you say, on the video. video shelves in a lot of homes, but it's not us. It's the moment. Mm-hmm. It's the community, the exhilaration, the utter grand feeling that mm-hmm. this lifted everybody. You forgot your troubles, you forgot your woes, and just allowed yourself to be happy people. It was wonderful.
Was it, if you could say, one of the happiest times of your career in TV, was one of the happiest moments ever?
Absolutely. I remember being in the skybox at the Dome when the final out, and mm-hmm. I was waiting for the Teflon to come down, and mm-hmm. that would have been okay as long as nobody got hurt. But it was magic. It was absolutely, Ruthie and I looked at each other like, is this true? Are we really here? Mm-hmm. And it was just a beautiful piece of serendipity that we were at the right place at the right time, at the right station, at the right moment. And thank the good Lord. It was wonderful.
And you and I are both realists. But did you think for a while, like, if this doesn't happen, this is going to be a sad moment for all of us, because we've seen so many. Minnesota's known for these choking moments of sports.
Well, 1965 came so close. Mm-hmm. Like, it was the LA,
Dodger.
LA team. Right,
Dodger.
And that was the old Met Stadium. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would have been a huge letdown, but still the pride would have been there. Mm-hmm. I think people would have held their heads up, and it still would have been a moment of joy that we got this far. Mm-hmm. We didn't quite, but we did make it. And then, like you said, a few years later, did it again. Mm-hmm. Marvelous. So I'm so grateful to have been there. I know everybody in the reporting business, especially grateful, just a sense of gratitude that we got to be part of this.
Well, I'm guessing you do enough all year round of some of such sad and tragic stories all year round. Yeah. We have enough natural disasters here in Minnesota that, do stories like that have to kind of make up for some of the tougher assignments that you end up doing over the years.
Often we hear from viewers who say, I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people. We like you, but we're tired of you and your, death, murder, and destruction every night. And mm-hmm. I said, something? I agree with you, and we hate delivering it as much as you mm-hmm. hate receiving it. And it's true. So something like this comes along, mm-hmm. and it's an antidote for everybody. It's just the medicine that you want, that you pray for, that you get. And it's the one that sticks with you. Mm-hmm. The bad stuff starts to recede in your memory, but you never forget, a World Series championship. And we long for those days to come, at least a competitive team out there on the field, again.
Nice. I just think of, like you were saying earlier, something to latch on to. People like the news anchors, they had something about you.
There was a real
was
connection there.
If we had another World Series like this, it would give a whole new crop of news anchors that attachment. Mm-hmm. People would go to them because they'd get to know them. They'd get to love them as they're getting
the same
news.
It would not be the same time. That's a very nice but a fanciful thought, because people are not watching news like they used to watch news.
Give me a World Series, it might change a little.
I would say age 30 and under, the so-called millennials, they're not watching. They're not. Things used to stop at 6 and 10 at night.
Sure.
They did in all age groups. The kids would be allowed to stay up to see what was going on. Mm-hmm. Then they'd go to bed and get up to school the next day. That's not it anymore. It's technology. It's a changing culture, and I see kids with their handhelds. That's where they get their news.
Well, I don't
dislike
any of the anchors up. I'm just neutral. But if you had a situation that was local,
Tom, to a degree, it would help. Yeah, sure. There would be a bonding again for sure. Joe Schmidt said something very, if I may interject.
Please.
I had Joe on. You did too. Mm-hmm. This, I think, it was last spring. Sammy mm-hmm. has a book out, and Joe sat here and he said something on the air, and I'll never forget this. And it's so right. And it really goes to how things have changed. He said, I was in a sports bar the other night with a couple of my buddies, and I looked over there, and there were some young guys, mm-hmm. Sports bar, 20, 23 years, about four, five, six of them. He said, a few years ago, I, Joe Schmidt, would have been mobbed. People, hey, you're on TV. We watch, it was not an ego trip for Joe. He just said that people like to come over and chat. These kids didn't even know who he was. They don't watch anymore. There's no connection anymore because things have changed so radically. It's really true.
Well, think of this also. Yeah. Right now, this was kind of the peak of, you had the chopper cams, you had all the helicopters are out, the satellite cameras are out. Channel 5 had a first, then 4 and 11 had theirs too. Right. The control of the message of the camera, there was very few cameras out there of this quality. Right now, everyone has a camera on their hand. So you would be seeing this same footage at the game or off the parade, but it'd be 50,000 YouTube uploads of everyone, everyone's journalist.
Oh, the graphics.
Yeah.
And this is the difference why, and I, in all due respect, our friend, we're kind of harping on Tom now.
Tom,
we're on your side. We really are.
There'll be someone will record these. Unfortunately, people don't even save tapes anymore because they have on DVR or they'll watch online.
That's another good point.
They're not going to have it in a box anymore that I can collect and put onto my site 30 years from now. But that's the difference. Is there's going to be so many messages out there that right now everyone has the same tape. Everyone has Game 7, Channel 5, October 25th, 1987. And because no one knew how to hit stop, the news rolls on afterward. And that's what I put on my site. we're not going to have that the next time it happens. It's going to be everyone else's video. There's going to be some wacky thing happen downtown. Someone will have some kind of, you know, sideshow incident downtown that'll make the news. It's not going to be the twins waving from their cars. Which, by the way, the men are wearing fur coats and the women are wearing fur coats. So that's
now everybody's a photographer. Everybody's correct. Essentially a TV photographer. They have their own video. We don't need TV. Mm-hmm. They'll say, you know, "Here, you want to see it? Here's my handheld. Take a look at what I just shot." Mm-hmm. And yeah, who needs TV?
I'm genuinely curious what's going to happen if, say, YouTube goes out of business or gets all the data destroyed. You are literally going to have 20 years worth of history that's going to vanish.
It's a void. Mm-hmm. It's a just black hole. Poof. You're right, Tom. Mm-hmm. That's scary.
It is scary. It's scary how much we're actually we're giving, and this is Office Laboratory sports moment, but we're giving a lot of our history in the possession of a few people, Google, YouTube.
Commercial entities.
And we're insisting that they're going to, you know, store it for us. I'm still in those dinosaurs that likes to have hard, needy copies of things that I think are important to me.
Sure.
And I save them, and we know this here.
Well, what's going to happen to your photo albums in 10 years when Facebook goes down?
That's why I keep them, Tom, on my external hard drive, which I think might be here. But that's
we need to find that.
We need to find that. We are – so I always encourage people, first of all, don't throw away your tapes. Don't throw your tapes. Don't throw away your photographs, throw your slides. Because something looks a little bit odd, you don't think you can put it, you know, see it right away. A lot of your former colleagues have come to me and said, "I wish I had not thrown my tapes away. I threw them away last year because I couldn't, you know, stand moving them anymore." I said, "I got a machine that could play them, and there's a lot of great history on there." Don't throw your family slides away because you got them from your grandparents. Because you know what, we know this. There's great, great slides of downtown Minneapolis, St. Paul, Stillwater, Minnesota, where you're from. There's some history there, and you know what your garbage might be someone else's treasure. Now, your old pantyhose, you know, you might want to throw those away. But, you know, photographs.
Don't keep those.
Yeah, exactly.
Tom, that was an interesting digression there.
That's right. I should say
that one of our new sponsors on my Saturday show, Images of the Past here in Stillwater, they are soliciting people to bring in their old photographs, their slides, whatever, their super 8mm. And he'll dub it onto DVD. And the name of the game is, like you said, preserve, save. Because it could go away easily. Control, Alt, Delete, and it's all gone.
As a client of his, he does great work. So I can personal experience working with him.
Mark Jensen's a terrific guy.
Fantastic.
So,
Stan,
there we are.
A moment in time. I'm glad you were part of it. I'm glad that
you've
been replayed in my VCR and on tcmedianow.com here so many times. Thank you always for coming on the show and giving us your insight and memories. It's been good.
I salute what you do, Tom Osmond, and this wonderful guy over here, Tom Shubidoo.
Oh,
you know,
go
he and
on.
I have been known to work together Monday through Friday, too, and you guys are terrific. You are.
Right back at you,
thank
sir.
Thank you, buddy.
Let's take a break. We'll come back, and we'll do some more news. Stan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond here. Great memories of the old 1987 World Series. Tom, do you remember that era and time? Or?
I do not remember the 87, but I do remember the next one, 91.
Well, see, we were.
I was at one of those games, and it was fantastic.
We were so used to that point, and then we didn't realize it was going to be another 35 years before we had another one. But I want to play a little bit more audio. This is actually from, the big. What do you do when you win the World Series? You go have a big parade, and then what's next?
Well, after that, after a big – gosh, I have no idea. I don't remember.
You meet the president.
Ah, that's it.
So let's play a little – well, I was going to say that. But here's some audio of our Minnesota Twins going to meet with President Reagan. If I just play it here. And when that loads.
That'll happen sometimes.
Yes. Well, it's thinking a second here. Technology.
But they're really a Minnesota team. We're represented here by our entire congressional delegation.
It's Martin Szabo.
Let me introduce them. Our two senators, Senator Boschwitz, Senator Durbinberger, Congressman Penny, Congressman Sikorsky, Congressman Veno, Congressman Frenzel.
Republicans and Democrats reunite for the Twins.
Former Second Lady of the country, Joan Mondale. I know that Jim Overstar and Win Weber are on their way over. This is a great day for us. And did I forget Frenzel?
Yeah. just because he plays football.
Just because Frenzel's the senior member of our delegation.
It's great they're wearing suits and Twins hats.
Come on, cheers for Bill. We're honored to have this opportunity to say thank you to the Twins. You know that I suppose a few of us were lucky to be able to see the World Series games. A few more get to see the Twins up at Baltimore. But for most of us, it's seeing them on TV. And unfortunately, the national networks didn't have them on Monday Night Baseball very often this year. So we get this opportunity and this chance to say thank you to a great group of athletes, a great organization. And it's my pleasure to make the first introduction today of a person who is a great human being. Oh, okay, I'm off key.
Okay, I found our Gipper audio here. He's getting his Gipper jersey from the Twins.
Minnesota Twins franchise has come a long way in the past 86 years. It started out as the Washington Senators, won the 24 World Series, lost in the 25 and 33 series, moved to Minnesota in 61, lost the 65 series, and finally ending up
in our stats.
Seventh game victory in front of 55,376 decibel-shattering fans. You know, one sportscaster announcing those games proclaimed, forget the decibel meter. How about the Richter scale? Or as second baseman Steve Lombardosi said, I wish all the fans that were out there tonight could stand in my shoes and feel the exhilarating feeling. It is beyond description. Well, Steve, I'm not sure those fans didn't feel a bit of the exhilaration. I know they felt the thunder. And you know, all this talk about baseball, I got to get in the game somehow myself here with a story. I set a record in baseball, Major League Baseball. I wasn't playing. I was a sports announcer. I was doing a telegraphic report game of the Cubs and the Cards. Dilly Jurgis at the plate, ninth inning, this game tied up. I saw my operator on the other side of the window, but headphones on, listening to the dot and dash from the field. I start typing, meaning that there was something, the ball was on the way to the plate, and so on. I didn't wait. I said that Dizzy Dean was on the mound, and I said, all right, Dean has got his sign. He's out of the windup. Here comes the pitch. And he was shaking his head no, and I took it, and it said, the wire has gone dead.
There we go. Ronald Reagan, Cubs announcer.
I guess it's just a weird thing for me to imagine. I think of an announcer having to be really fast-paced. Oh, no, he's moving over there. I can't see him doing it.
Well, he might have, but that was, you know, in 1920 when he might have been. Well,
oh, true.
Not that
it's
old.
Just you have an image of somebody, and somebody like Reagan who speaks very slowly, very articulately, I just have a hard time seeing him speeding up and going incredibly quickly.
He wasn't exactly – he was giving a very dignified presidential speech here at the Minnesota Twins. He's flanked by Tom Kelly and Carl Pohlad. This video is also on tcmedianow.com. You know, Ronald Reagan in his youth, his younger days, you know, of course he was an actor, but he was also a play-by-play announcer for the Chicago Cubs, but he did it from Iowa. He did it from WHO radio in Iowa.
Without even seeing it.
He got teletype, and he would announce, so for example, I'd be giving you some script, and then you would read it as if you're watching a baseball game.
You know, that's got to be so hard, because, I mean, you don't know what the punchline is going to be of the sentences, and he throws it, oh my God, how'd it go?
We don't know the trouble that we had in those days. No, it's a pretty interesting little tidbit in Ronald Reagan's life, but he gets a Gipper jersey from the Minnesota Twins, which I think is pretty nice whenever we give our presidents a jersey. I remember when Mike Tyson, there's a name, I remember he gave George Bush a jersey. He got a little flack for that, but it was a Bush jersey, Vikings jersey.
Sure.
Never did see him wear it in any speeches, but you know he has it.
Well, what the hey, you know?
I want to pivot a little bit, and this is a story you might have talked about this week, but I want to read the story because it kind of comes close to home. This is an obituary. Kay Sexton knew what Twin Cities and America wanted to read. This is from TwinCities.com. Kay Sexton, a former vice president of B. Dalton Bookseller, whose reading recommendations were nationally influential, died Friday at her home in Arden Hills. She was 91 had been declining health for several years, according to her niece, Leslie Walters. Sexton, who never married but mentored many young booksellers and writers, were honored by friends of the St. Paul Public Library in 1988 when they established the K. Sexton Award for Outstanding Contributions to the Minnesota Literary Community. The award, which has been given to publishers, authors, librarians, is presented to the annual Minnesota Book Awards Spring Gala. Kay was sharp. She always knew when a title was going to be great before anyone else in the country, said Norton Stillman, one of Sexton's oldest friends. They met in the early 1960s when she was selling books at a St. Paul department store. Stillman, publisher of Norton Press and former co-owner of the Bookman Book Distribution in Minneapolis, recalled Sexton contacted him late one afternoon in the Bookman when she was managing B. Dalton's flagship store in Southdale. She asked me to drop off copies of, wait for it, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex because she knew it was going to be a big seller, Stillman recalled on Monday. You look at this picture, you just don't want her to think about her, you know, buying these books.
Really?
That's fine. When she was managing the Southdale store, everybody called it Kay's store because she knew what she wanted to do and didn't pay attention to the buyers. That has always worked well in my career. I think that's what made her a vice president. They put her at the headquarters. Sexton's uncanny ability to pick winning books showed her weekly in-house newsletter, officially known as Hooked on Books, but affectionately referred to in the bookselling world as the Green Sheet. The publication, which featured Sexton's thoughts on what books would appeal to middle America, became the Bible of the publishing industry. Sexton's friend, Gail C., said, "Publishers would do anything to get Kay to put one of their titles in her newsletter. I called her the Force." She was president of the American Booksellers Association, a trade group for independent booksellers, in the days when B. Dalton was considered the enemy. She remembers calling Sexton with some trepidation to invite her to an ABA board meeting. The ABA board thought this was amiss because there was such tension between independents and Dalton, recalled C., a former owner of the Bookcase in Wayzata. But she came, and once we reached out to her, she was always a great bridge between her company and bookstores. We became good friends, and I always admired her the way she was very wise and able to put things in perspective. She was a wonderful storyteller. Among authors to whom Sexton gave thoughtful advice to was President Richard Nixon, who, according to Jeff Holman, was B. Dalton Divisional Merchandise Manager with an office adjacent to Sexton's at the company's West Bloomington headquarters. Quote, "One day I answered the phone when Kay wasn't there, and it was Nixon," Holman recalled. Huh. "When his book, The Real War, came out in 1980, he was concerned how it was doing. He would call Kay once a week, and they'd have a little chat. Not Nixon to the phone, just here, I'll just, is Kay around?
Tell Mr. Nixon to hold on. I'm getting tea.
I'm reading Everything You Wanted to Know About some topic." Holman, a documentary filmmaker, has no doubt Sexton told the president exactly what she thought. Kay was singular, honest with everybody, including the chairman of the company, he said. Sexton first hired Holman as a bookseller when she was manager of the Southdale store, and he was impressed by her approach to books and customers. "It didn't matter to Kay what your tastes were. She'd hand you a book and tell you exactly why it was for you, and you'd walk away knowing it was just right for your soul." David Unowski, a Sexton Award winner and former owner of the Hungry Mind Ruminator Books, called Sexton the person who made B. Dalton the dominant bookseller in America for 15 years. They were the first to bring authors to the Twin Cities in the days when touring authors only went to the coasts and Chicago. She was the driving force behind that. Her office in West Bloomington was a place where major people in the industry went to bow down. Garrison Keillor met Sexton in 1982, and his first book, Happy to Be Here, came out, and she attended his signing. Kay had a tremendous enthusiasm about books and writers, in sharp contrast to our old, embittered English professors, and that was a great revelation to me, Keillor recalled. "When you're starting out, you really can use a good word from a knowledgeable person, and she was that for sure. A good word from Kay, and you were set for life." Besides sending out her green sheet, Sexton was a local celebrity because of her weekly television show, Hooked on Books. "I looked, I can't find it, but now I've found a new mission. I got to find Hooked on Books because I want to find out, you know, the week they reviewed that other book."
Sure.
Marty Russoff, a Sexton Award winner who owned the Dinkytown Bookstore where the Loft Library Center began, was a young sales rep when going to see Kay was a highlight of a season for me. Russoff, a former vice president of several New York publishing houses, is a New York literary agent and publisher. Kay made New York publishers sit up and take notice of Zen and the Art of the Motorcycle Maintenance when nobody was paying any attention, Russoff recalled of St. Paulite Robert Persick's book. Kay was first of all a passionate reader, the best in town, with a keen sense of what people would be interested in. Everybody who came in contact with Sexton applauds her role as a mentor. Her family recalls that her bookcase-lined office held the couch, where everyone from secretaries to book buyers and CEOs would come by to pour out their hearts and ask for advice. Her straightforward advice, know your values, be true to your beliefs, and follow your passion. Sexton's three nephews and six nieces also benefited from her aunt's wisdom. Kay was a go-to person when any of us had angst or needed something, a sounding board, said Mary Sexton, oldest of the cousins, and Kay Sexton's goddaughter. We were all kind of terrified of her because she said what she thought, and it wasn't always exactly what we wanted to hear. She had strong opinions, and you did not cross that. Mary Sexton, who worked at Odegaard Books in St. Paul and was a publisher's sales rep and bookseller in New York, said she never saw her aunt angry, although she could get irritated. When Mary Sexton was a young woman, she had no idea of her aunt's importance until she was in college and walked into B. Dalton Bookstore in New Orleans. There was Kay's picture hanging on the wall. Mary Sexton recalled, I knew she was a big deal because she would send me a green sheet, but I didn't make any connection until, gosh, I saw her picture. Kay Sexton retired. She helped create the Minnesota Center for Book Arts and served on the board of the Minneapolis-based Gray Wolf Press. She was legally blind in her last years, but her spirit stayed strong as she welcomed visitors to her luncheon table. Kay Sexton, a true Minnesota legend. And if you recall B. Dalton, that was in every single mall, not only here in Minnesota, but also across the country. And, you know, you just don't go to a little bookstore anymore, go to a bookstore anymore.
No, I'm glad you read this because, yeah, my only experience with any of this was B. Dalton's bookstore. Mm-hmm. I went to the one over in Rosedale Mall, mm-hmm. and every time my mom and I went over there, it was the place I had to go.
You go straight for the pop-up books.
the science fiction pop-up books, mm-hmm. absolutely.
No, it was, you know, they were great. They were small stores. They were, yeah,
they
you
were
go to,
small.
And
yeah.
By the way, we have you know, River Valley Books, you know, booksellers across the street, great mm-hmm. store. We have the antique bookstore down the road, which I frequent quite often. But the you know, chain bookstores, the Barnes & Nobles, which unfortunately are shrinking because, you know, you do need to buy books, but borders are gone. I remember the first time I went to a Barnes & Noble, and at first you think, like, wow, more books. But the problem is, mm-hmm. oh, more books. It's two or three levels of books and coffee and computers and CDs and movies. And
that sounds wonderful.
You know, we've been talking a lot about how we, you know, we sound like old men here, you know, longing for the old days. But you miss that going into B. Dalton, and there's, you know, between myself and, you know, and your studio there, that's where you went to go find a book. You got to find your latest Beverly Cleary title you want to read because you just learned how to read a chapter book. Choose your own adventure.
Oh, I had a – you know what? I had a couple choose-your-own-adventures that I purchased at B. Dalton's.
And here's a little trivia for you. B. Dalton. Maybe you might not know this. B. Dalton, you know what that stands for? That's
– No.
That's Bruce Dayton. It was a Dayton company.
Really?
But Dayton looked better as Dalton on a bookstore sign.
You know what? I can see that.
So one with B. Dalton. It was – I believe the quote was, it was more dignified to be B. Dalton.
I wonder who got to deliver that news. The name does not look good. We need to change it.
But you'll make more money.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, exactly. In that case.
And sold to Barnes & Noble in 1986. The last B. Dalton closed in 2013. There was three left until 2013.
All right. I think the one I was familiar with probably went away in about 1998.
Well, you had your choice of going between Walden Books and B. Dalton. And I think that, it, you know, you had to go either upstairs to, you know, Walden Books or downstairs mm-hmm. to B. Dalton. You had a big choice.
Well, I was very surprised. You mentioned Borders. That one was over at Rosedale. Like you said, it was three stories.
Well, a brand new one.
It was or two stories anyway. It was huge. Fantastic place, always busy whenever I went in there, and it just poof overnight it seemed to vanish. Is yeah. that Barnes and Noble right there that got
the,
it, or
the Circle? I think it is. I think it is a Bucks on Painted Furniture. No, I'm not sure what it is right now. I think it's a furniture store. Actually, I think I walked through there like, oh, that's where the bookstore was.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But let's also in other events. I know you saw this, and I saw this, and I knew we had to tell this today because
oh, of course.
Our audience loves this show. The Simpsons, we talk about that sometimes on the show. It's a great institution of America. Goodfellas actor claims Simpson stole his likeness in lawsuit.
And it took him 25 years to bring something.
23 years after The Simpsons introduced the Springfield Mafia actor Frank Severo has filed a – not doing the number here, how much he's filing this lawsuit for?
I do know the number.
$250 million lawsuit against Fox Television Studios for basing one of the three animated wise guys on his Goodfellas character, Frankie Carbone.
He was, I think, in 15 episodes, and he wants $250 million. I was reading the details of this, and I guess he was friends with
James L. Brooks.
James
well?
L. Brooks, and Brooks said, oh, we'll do a movie project together.
You're ahead of me here.
Oh, go
Severo
ahead.
Claims in a lawsuit filed on Tuesday in Los Angeles Superior Court that in 1989 he lived in Sherman Oaks apartment door next to – I'm sorry. He lived in a Sherman Oaks apartment next door to the Simpsons writers that Simpsons producer James L. Brooks was highly aware of who Severo was. I like this quote, highly aware. Simpsons character Louie would be based on his character. This is a quote. During this time, both writers knew who Severo was, and they saw each other almost every day, the complaint alleges. They knew he was developing the character he was going to play in the movie's Goodfellas, a movie Severo did in 1989. In fact, they were aware the entire character of Frankie Carbone was created and developed by Severo, who based this character on his own personality. The character of Louie appeared in 16 episodes of Simpsons, the first time in 1991. According to the complaint, the Fox long-running hit has grossed $12 billion from several revenue streams, mostly because of this character, right?
Oh, Tom? Okay. Yeah. $250
million
at least.
Video games. Fox Southern Studios did not respond immediately for a request for comment. Now, I would say and laugh about this unless I had laughed at other lawsuits this year and somehow I've been proven wrong. We had a very prominent attorney in here who also laughed at a lawsuit this summer, which was proven wrong. So
yeah.
I'm going to be careful when I laugh at lawsuits right here. I think I have a little audio here if you want to just kind of
used to have so many.
As soon as this little ad for bathroom tissues is over with on there.
But, you know, it's very strange. It it does make a dent in the idea of parody.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can do parodies of people. I think Reagan's been on The Simpsons, a picture of him, or a close offshoot. I don't know if he can sue for that kind of thing. Granted, he's a politician and not an actor. But what happens when you can't parody an individual anymore?
So I think the here's some audio. This is actually only a minute here. This is from today's show discussing the same topic here. There we go.
Yeah. Actor from the movie Goodfellas suing The Simpsons, claiming the show ripped off his mobster character. Okay, so this is what the actor looks like. His name is Frankie Severo.
They look alike.
And here's Louie, the character he's talking about. Severo says he once lived next to a pair of the writers for The Simpsons.
He's got a case.
Okay, and a producer for the show knew about him. So now Severo is suing the creators for $250 million.
Wow. Al Roker's he's amazed by it, too.
Well, it's... I think he honestly does have a point. I mean, it is – they look exactly the same. They sound different, but they look exactly the same. If he was going for maybe $1 million or something, that's one thing. But $250 million in lost wages and damages, a little over the top.
I just like the idea now for lawsuit. You go maximum full amount and see maybe
eyeball him.
Just see. Maybe he'll get $100 million.
You know, something teeny.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I have a Halloween story for you, which I want you to brace yourself. You might get a little bit frightened, but I have some American folklore for you, a little music, and we'll close things off. Flashback Film Studios, Tom Osmond. So, Halloween is among us. The next time we meet, Halloween will have passed. You'll have, Tom, I'm sure you have your costume picked out. You have your jack-o'-lanterns carved and glowing.
They all look like William Shatner at this point.
Well, that would be all the pumpkins I saw at Kowalski's today. The Legend of Sleepy Hollow is my favorite Halloween story. And I just want to read a little bit here, and then I even have some audio. Which you might get scared for, so if you have young children, you know, might want to hold their hand.
I'm ready for it, man.
The Legend of Sleepy Hollow is a short story by American author Washington Irving, contained in his collection of 34 essays and short stories entitled The Sketchbook of Jeffrey Cranion Gent. Written while Irving was living abroad in Birmingham, England, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow was first published in 1820 along with Irving's companion piece, Rip Van Winkle. Along with Irving's, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow is among the earliest examples of American fiction with enduring popularity. In Disney, which sometimes we can be hard on Disney for taking classic American folklore and botching it.
Making them so that kids can see them?
Well, they did a good job with this one. This is one of the earliest, videos or films I ever remember seeing of Disney. It was Mr. Toad and Legend of Sleepy Hollow. And the actual Sleepy Hollow film itself, it's a half hour, it doesn't end very cheerfully. It's much like Disney's early work. It is a bit dark. It's a bit scary. Bing Crosby narrates and sings in this, and it's just brilliant. And I want to, in our last few minutes here of the show here, I want to play this audio. This is a Legend of Sleepy Hollow song. So if you allow me, here we go.
Gather around and I'll elucidate on what goes on outside when it gets late. Long about midnight, the ghosts and banshees, they get together for their nightly jamboree. There's things with horns and saucer eyes, some with fangs about this size.
Some are fat, and some are thin.
And some don't even wear their skin. Oh, I'm telling you, brother, it's a frightful sight to see what goes on Halloween night. Oh, when spooks are having a jamboree, they break it up with fiendish glee. Ghosts are bad, but the one that's cursed is the headless horseman. He's the worst.
That's right, he's the kind on Halloween night.
But when he goes a jogging across the land, holding his noggin in his hand, demons take one look and groan, and they hit the road for far to know.
Beware, take care, he rides alone.
And there's no spook like Spookett's bird.
They don't like him and he's really burned.
He swears to the longest day he's dead,
he'll show them that he can get ahead.
They say he's tired of his flaming top. He's got a yen to make a swap. So he rides one night each year to find a head in the hollow here.
Now he likes them little, he likes them big.
Or in the middle or awake.
Black or white or even red.
The headless horseman needs a head with
a hip, hip and a clippity clap.
He's out looking for a chop-chop. So don't stop to figure out a plan. You can't reason with a headless man. Now if you doubt this tale is so, I met that spook just a year ago. Now I didn't stop for a second look, but made for the bridge that spans the brook. But once you cross that bridge, my friend,
the ghost is through his power end.
So when you're riding home tonight, make for the bridge with all your might. He'll be down in the hollow there. He needs your head. Look out, beware!
With a hip, hip, and a clippity-clop, he's out looking for a head to swap. So don't try to figure out a plan. You can't reason with a headless man.
Scared?
Oh, I'm terrified. That was one of the first things I ever saw as a kid.
It's a great film. Check it out. Run to the night with the kids. It's a great night to watch a scary movie, or maybe The Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown.
You know, I watched it again, that Legend of Sleepy Hollow, just maybe last year. I was really surprised at just how little horror is actually in the movie. It's 24 minutes of buildup of just, you know, drama, and hanging out, having a party, and the last 6 minutes or so, it actually has some horror element to it.
Psychological, my friend, psychological.
That's what I said.
Next Saturday, Paul Douglas will be on the show. We'll be looking forward to that conversation for a while. He'll be talking about maybe some weather.
We're going to have Paul Douglas?
Paul Douglas.
All right.
He might have some idea. He might have some weather things to talk about. And you know what? We've been known in this town to have blizzards in Halloween, so we might be shoveling by the time we meet next.
No. It's too nice.
Looking forward to that. Thank you again, Stan Turner. Again, 27 years today, the Twins won the World Series. I'll post that video to not only the TC Media Now page, but also KLB's Facebook page in case anyone wants to click on that and see Stan and all the joy we had that day and remember what things were like in the old days.
I'm trying to remember what it was like in 91.
Yeah, aren't we all? Well, until next Saturday, Flashback Twin Cities here on KLB Club 1220. See you later.